botched up. It's visiting here from Harvard. I won't embarrass anyone, including myself, by saying how I first, when I first met Sabir, but I guess I've known him for a long time. And he's done a lot of important work on quantum spin systems. Chris has worked in the whole area of strongly correlated condensed matter systems. More recently, he's gotten into this area of AES-CFT correspondence and trying to use it on correlated spin systems. And I told him not to bring slides or transparencies. So he can talk a little bit, and then you guys will probably have questions to make some talk about it.
So, okay, well, thanks, John. I remember when I first met you. You came and gave a talk at Bell Labs when I was a postdoc there.
Oh, but did I actually meet you? I
met you before that.
You were at Harvard graduate student,
right.
2 years behind Catherine.
That's right. Your memory is better than mine.
Yes.
Anyway, okay, so how many of you were at my talk yesterday? Okay, a fair number. But I'm not going to assume that. I mean, so, you know, if you have any, maybe I just start out by asking you what you want me to talk about. If not, I will just launch into some of the things I'm interested in and some of the research opportunities I see in the future in the fields that I work on. But if somebody wants to say something or ask me something, that will also help direct what I talk about. I mean, are most of you interested in graduate school in theoretical physics? Is that where? Okay, great. All right, so as John mentioned, for most of my career, I've been a condensed matter physicist working on problems related in some way, directly or indirectly, to high temperature superconductivity. I mean, high temperature superconductivity discovered in 1987 when I was a postdoc at Bell Labs. And so that's the right time for me to jump into the field. And the field's come a long way. There's been a lot of excitement. It's been much tougher than people thought, but also in many ways much richer. There's so many new phenomena that have come out and so much advances in theoretical physics, partly directed by experiments, but also a lot of interesting theoretical tools and methods that have been developed. But more recently, so in the course of working on high temperature superconductivity, I developed a special interest in quantum phase transitions, which are analogs of thermal phase transition, but at zero temperature. And I'll give you, perhaps you've already learned a few, I'll give you some simple examples. And while studying quantum phase transitions, we came upon, my students and I, some rather difficult problems on how to describe physical properties of systems which are near quantum phase transitions. And we developed some of approximate methods, but they didn't, we were not sure how accurate they were. Also there were no numerical tools. It's just the whole problem couldn't be formulated numerically. Maybe I'll say a bit more about why. So that's sort of where things stood for a while, but then there was, this AES-CFT correspondence that John mentioned that came out of string theory by Juan Marlezena. And then it was realized that this correspondence would actually say some very interesting things about quantum critical points. So that's been a main interest of mine in the last 5 years or so. This only happened about 5 years ago. It's a feel like when I wrote the first paper on this, I thought, oh, two people will read it and this will be dead immediately. But it seems to have grown enormously. There's a lot of people working on it, and many, surprising things are being achieved. And if you were at my talk yesterday, even things like metals and strange metals are now, they're semi-realistic models of those using string theory. I haven't had any of my students actually work on this area because I thought it was too speculative. All of my students have so far been mainstream condensed matter people. But maybe in the future, now that I see it becoming a little more of a bigger field, I've had several postdocs working on it, of course. But I thought it was too speculative for a while for a student. But maybe not. I think now there's enough people doing it and there's enough established results that And there's a lot of, and also more importantly, there's, I think there's scope for many new things. There's a lot of opportunities that I see, you know, of progress that can be made. And many people are working on it and get cracking quickly. Just this morning, there was a very interesting paper on the same thing I talked about yesterday by a graduate student from Stanford. So I never read him before, but it looks very interesting. anyway, so that's kind of a summary of the kind of things I'm thinking about these days. Have you have questions so far? All right, yeah.
Do you think that hackathons work on ductility will explain text
variation? Yes, I get that question every time. No, good question. Well, it depends what you mean by explain. So the models we can solve from ADS-CFT are, at the simplest level, they're just very artificial supersymmetric field theories that have definitely don't have any analog in anything in the real world. But you can deform them and then try to understand general properties of strongly interacting matter and understand different possible phases and different distinctions between different phases. And that kind of broad understanding, I think, will have an impact on superconductivity. So I mean, we're dealing here with some of the most difficult problems in theoretical physics, in a sense, because it's even more difficult than particle physics or QCD. QCD is some strongly coupled non-Hopkinian gauge theory, but in principle, you can put it on a computer, and if you have a big enough computer, you can get all the numbers you want, and that's been quite successful in the last few years. But this these kind of problems, you can't put them on a computer because of this famous sign problem. You have to do a Feynman-Path integral over weights that don't have all the same sign. So even in principle, you cannot put it on a computer. And there are no null algorithms that don't grow exponentially with the system size. So it's basically impossible. So we are using whatever tools we can think of, and ADS-CFT turns out to be a remarkably powerful tool that continues to yield new insights so far. And I think, so in that, the sense of global insights, I think it will be important for understanding various aspects of these correlated electron systems.
You mentioned established results.
Established results?
Yeah, you were saying we have some established results.
Yes, okay. What do I think about? You want me to talk about which was?
Yeah, okay,
so I'll talk about it.
Yeah.
So let me talk about a particular program that's undergoing, and it still requires some more work, but there's a lot of optimistic signs that this is going to eventually perhaps even become quantitative for some experiments. So let me just step back and try to give you a flavor of how, what the basic ideas of the field are. And I guess I should have said earlier, one of the exciting things right now is that ideas from condensed matter physics and phase theory of phase transition and condensed matter physics, string theory, and also from quantum information are all coming together and really influencing development of these ideas. So let me just start. I don't know, you all know the method of second quantization, and I write down Hamiltonians with operators and so on. Okay, so perhaps Nandini talked about this. Did you hear about the Boson-Hubbard model and the superfluid insulator transition? No. Yeah,
that is a little bit.
Little bit. Okay, so then I'll say a bit more.
Condensed matter core.
Yeah. So this particular example is motivated by cool atoms, but there are analogous problems in condensed matter systems too. So you take a bunch of bosons and cool them to low temperatures. And you ask what are the possible ground states boson can form. And normally, if you take any Bose system and cool it to low enough temperatures, it will Bose condense and become a superfluid. However, if you take your bosons and put them in a periodic potential, you have some background potential, and the cold atom systems, you create this by a standing beam of laser light, and then you send your atoms, there's a big trap that's much larger than the wavelength of this potential. So trap is relatively flat here, so you can just ignore it. And the bosons come in and start moving around in this optical lattice. And under suitable regime, there's only one, so there's, you know, if I look at this well, there's a quantum state here and a quantum state here at some energy. And if you choose your parameters right, that's really the only states that's occupied by any bosons. Okay, so you have these states here. Now let me not draw the wave function anymore. And now you put the bosons in. So here's a boson here and a boson there. And what these bosons are going to want to do is to tunnel between different sites. Now if you had a, and so there's sort of two energy scales. There's the tunneling matrix element for the boson to tunnel through, which I call T. And then there's a repulsion between two bosons. So when you put two bosons on the same site, this costs an energy U. Okay, so you have to compare the magnitudes of T and U. So when U is very small, these are just free particles. They don't interact with each other, and they will undergo Bose condensation. So now you can ask, you know, what happens when you keep adding more and more bosons and you turn up the value of U. In the experiments, what they actually do is they turn down the value of T, but things only depend on the ratio. So let's just think in terms of turning up the value of U. So if you turn up the value of U, these states, you know, are not allowed. They cost too much energy, and you're going to put the bosons as far apart from each other as you can. And now you see that there's, if the density of bosons is exactly one, so there's one per site, then there's a perfect state here. You have one boson in every well, and that's called and in that state, you know, the bosons just are prohibited from tunneling, because if they tunnel, you gain an energy T, but you lose an energy U, and so why do it? Just basically be trapped here. And so this state where the bosons are not tunneling at all is an insulator, so it's very different from a superfluid. And one way you might see this is if you take this periodic potential, you would tilt it a little bit, and in fact they do these experiments, if you tilt it a little bit, nothing happens, the bosons don't flow. Whereas if there was a superfluid state, then if you tilted it, immediately you'd get essentially flow without dissipation of the bosons. And so you can detect that perturbation very easily in these cold atom experiments. So if you, so then you see that as a function of U over T, for the case of exactly this density, there are two possible phases. If U over T is very large and there's no tunneling, you get what's called a mod insulator. And if U over T is very small, you get a superfluid. Okay, so because when U over even, you know, it doesn't matter what the density is, if the bosons don't see each other, each boson will just independently tunnel through the lattice because U is extremely small. Okay, and so now, you know, for any finite system, of course, there's some kind of qualitative smooth crossover between these two opposing limits. But if you had a truly infinite system, then there is a way of sharply distinguishing the superfluid from the mod insulator. And one sharp distinction is that is to ask whether there's an energy gap above the ground state. So the ground state in this case is superfluid, and there are lots of low energy excitations corresponding to the bosons tunneling through the lattice. So essentially by having very long wavelength excitations, you can get arbitrary and low energy states. On the other hand, on the mod insulating side, it always costs some energy to create, to move the bosons around. And so there's a gap between the ground state and the first excited state. And this gap, therefore, turns on at a very special value, which is some critical value here, some UC over T. And this is the position of a quantum phase transition, or a QPT. Okay. So this is then a sharp phase transition for an infinite system of bosons at absolute zero between a superfluid state and a mod insulator. Now, exactly how we know it's sharp and you know, have to involve concepts in quantum field theory and symmetry breaking and so on, which I guess for a lecture like this I don't want to go into, but perhaps some of you know that. You know, and if you're hearing about the Higgs boson, there's an analog of the Higgs boson excitation here as the superfluid, as you restore the symmetry from the superfluid phase into the mod insulator. And that's been seen in experiments in condensed matter a long time ago. Well, 4 or 5 years ago. anyway, so what's so special about this quantum critical point and this quantum phase transition, and why does it lead to a whole class of challenging problems? So one way to think about it is to actually try to write down some simple wave function for the ground state of this boson system as a function of u over t. So what would you do? So let's take the bosons on each side, b sub I. And then you can also define b sub k, which is sum on I b I e to the I k dot r I. So this is an operator that annihilates a boson on site I. These sites are labeled I. And this is an operator that annihilates a boson with momentum k. Just take a linear combination. All right. So what is the superfluid? The superfluid is basically every boson tunneling freely through the lattice, which means its wave function is basically constant, meaning that it's in the zero momentum state. So the superfluid ground state is actually extremely simple. It's just B dagger. You take every, this is K equals zero. You take the bosons and create them in the zero momentum state, and you take n of them and hit on the vacuum, and that gives you the ground state. So you have n particles, you put every particle in zero momentum state, and that's your superfluid ground state. And that's, of course, the Bose-Einstein condensate. On the other hand, for the mod insulator, what is the ground state? Well, the ground state, again, is very simple. It's like billiard balls, and it's like marbles in a it's very classical looking. We're putting the particles in each marble in its own box, and so you're putting the particles on a given site with bi, not k. So what you want to do is you take product from I equals, you have n particles, b dagger I, this is the site label, and hit it on zero. So these are very different looking states. You can rewrite this slightly differently if you want. This you can write as up to some normalization as b sum on I b dagger I to the power n acting on zero. So you notice there's a crucial difference between this state and this state, that you're now using the same operators here. But here, when you expand out this thing, you get lots and lots of terms. So this thing, if I just say I have three sites and three particles, just to give an example, this would have terms like b dagger 1 cubed plus b dagger 2 cubed plus b dagger 3 cubed plus b dagger 1 squared b 2 and so on and so forth, plus also b dagger 1, b dagger 2, b dagger 3 acting on zero. These are the kind of terms you get. And you notice that these are terms where you have lots of fluctuations in the number of particles on each side. If you have three particles on one side and zero on the others, if you have two on one and zero, one on this and zero on the third, and there's only one term where you have exactly one particle on each side, and that's the term here. Okay, so the mod insulator has zero number fluctuations. You have exactly one particle per site, at least in this simple state. Whereas the superfluid has lots of number fluctuating. So that's another way to think about what a superfluid is. It's a state where the boson number on any side is fluctuating over very large values. And it's that fluctuation in the boson number, meaning that implies that the bosons can move around also very, very easily. Okay, but here I want to focus on another aspect of the state. These are not the exact wave functions, but they are also have a common feature, which is that here this is simply a product state. You're just taking one operator and hitting it n times. And here also, you're just taking a bunch of operators on the side and just taking a product. So in some appropriate base, so these are the product states. So quantum mechanically, what you say is that neither state, so there's a simple product state. So this is a kind of a loose word, but anyway, I'm going to use it. Neither state is entangled. So these are very different states, and you do have interesting quantum effects in both of them. But they don't have this entanglement that you get in the EPR type experiments where there's some correlations between what the atoms are doing in some non-local way between different sites. They're just simple products in the appropriate basis. Okay, so now if you now ask what does the ground state look like as you go across between here and here, between the superfluid and the mod insulator, what you find is that right at this point, there is where in some sense you can make precise, the entanglement is maximum. So this state here at the critical point has non-local entanglement. So it's as if just the interactions themselves create so EPR pairs between atomic positions, and these pairs extend over infinite distance, effectively at zero temperature. So you have a very novel state here, and I can't write down a wave function for it. In high enough dimensions, you can. If you're above three or four dimensions, this is relatively simple. But in one and two, which are the most interesting dimension, I can't write it down. It's just too complicated. Nobody has a wave function that makes sense over here. There are various numerical techniques, and those have been very useful here. And there's also field theoretical technique. So right, what you find here, what makes this thing tractable is that this critical point, because of the long-range nature of it, you can write on a continuum description. So there's some entanglement over long scales, so you might believe a continuum description works. And for this particular model, in fact, you even know what that continuum theory is. It's a rather complicated theory, but it's something that string theorists are also interested in. It's a conformal field theory. So it has conformal symmetry and lots of other beautiful aspects to it, but it still describes this, it also has relativistic symmetry and so on, but it does describe then a generic superfluid insulator transition. So the remarkable fact is you take any Boson-Hubbard model, I didn't put any restrictions really on whether the tunneling was only nearest neighbor, whether it was on a square lattice or a triangle lattice, whether I had second neighbor repulsion, anything. You can just take a generic model. As long as you have density of bosons 1, and you at this critical point between the superfluid and the mod insulator, you get a low energy theory that has all these beautiful features. It's conformally invariant, it's relativistically invariant. Of course, the relativistically invariant with respect to some velocity, which is the velocity of sound, not light. Yeah?
Like we are in 1.
So these statements are in 2 and 1. In 3D, it's almost conformal, not quite. So in 1 and 2, the most interesting case is 2, which is either case of focus on 1. It's a fairly simple conformal field theory, this critical point, which is well understood.
So it's not like a chain.
So I'm putting it on a square lattice, for example, yes. That's the most interesting case. And that also, similar to experiments in condensed matter, like cuprates, which are also two-dimensional. So you can make a 2D lattice. There's several groups around the world who have these lattices now and are beginning to study more carefully what's happening near this critical point. Yeah?
And do you know which conformal field theory is?
Oh, yeah. In this case, we know it. It's something called the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, or the ON model. It's the O2 model with strong interactions. Right. So we know, in fact, so at this point you say, oh, fine, you've identified the field theory. So then you open your StatMech book or your field theory book or your particle physics book. Just read off everything here and compare with experiment. So why don't you just do that? And what's the big deal? Well, okay, that's already a big deal, really. That's a big deal. But it's not as easy as that. And one of the reasons is that certain things, the kind of things people who work in conformal 3D like to calculate are what they call scaling dimensions and critical exponents and things like that. And those, for this particular model, we know extremely well now because of all this other work that was done in the theory of phase transitions in the 70s for completely different motivations, thinking about the Curie transition and the ferromagnet and so on, or the liquid gas transition that you learn about from van der Waals. That also, in the end, is related to a conformal field theory in three dimensions. And very similar field theories also apply here. Okay. But because of the quantum nature, there are a number of other questions that arise that were not addressed in the traditional theory. And that especially have to do with the fact that this system is never really, you know, I mean, anytime you're doing an experiment, you're never really at zero temperature. And I've been making these broad statements about zero temperature wave functions and ground state. It's never really in the ground state. It's always at some non-zero temperature. And so you really should have another axis, which is temperature here and U over T over here with the quantum critical point here. Okay. So now I can ask, you know, what happens at finite temperature? So here, in the case of two dimensions, is what I'm going to restrict myself to. Well, okay, so this isn't a lecture on some of my research, but let me just say that the basic thing that happens at finite temperature is that you get a regime here, which is called the quantum critical regime for obvious reasons. Where you have to worry about not just this entangled ground state, but also a whole soup of excitations above it. And so one of the challenging problems that arises then is to how do you describe these finite temperature dynamics of this soup of excitations here. Okay, so now if you step back, well, how do physicists normally describe anything at finite temperature? So the analog of it is just the equation of Brownian motion. You write down, you assume you have some particle-like objects moving around, you put in some collision cross-section, and you write down a Brownian motion or some Boltzmann equation, we describe how these particles move around. It sounds like a simple thing to state, but it's been an extremely powerful and successful approach. It basically applies to almost everything in finite matter physics. It applies to metals, provided you choose the right quasi-particles around the Fermi surface. It applies to superfluids, provided your quasi-particles there are these long wavelength sort of phonon excitations. And it applies to the Mohr insulator also, where your quasi-particle is simply particle hold state. So you can now, if I'm in this Mohr insulating state, I can take a particle and put this over here. And now this guy can hop around at finite temperature without any energy cost once it's created. And so can this move around. So you have this doublon moving here and this hole moving here. And so you can write on a Boltzmann equation for the doublons and holes, and that works. It just generally works. Okay. So the key idea in all of this treatment of finite temperature dynamics is the idea that excitations of even very complicated quantum systems are basically little lumps that look like a particle. And these lumps interact with each other. And so this particle concept is really crucial in almost everything that's traditionally been done in condensed matter physics. But the whole point is that right here, there's no such thing. The ground state is entangled, the excitations are entangled, and there is no concept of a particle, and there are no control methods to address them. So that's one of the hard problems then that even this very simple model raises, and the many experiments on these. And so this was something, you know, we started thinking about, I guess, late 90s. And then we developed some methods. These were approximate methods based upon so-called 1 over n expansions and epsilon expansions. But they were really based on hope. We had no real control, but, you know, we could do something semi-systematically, but we had no idea how accurate our answers were because there was nothing to test them against, at least on some other theory or something else. Okay. And it's precisely for these questions, it turns out quite amazingly, that this ADS-CFT duality works beautifully. It hasn't been tested so far for the Bose-Hubbard model, but there's a program on how eventually, you know, I'm optimistic that eventually they will be at a level where with some fairly sophisticated matching procedure, we'll be able to test the ADS description of the CFT in experiments on things like the Bose-Hubbard model. So that's sort of my dream over the next 10 years, 5, 10 years. I think it's achievable. And all the pieces are in place, just requires a little bit more hard work, both by theory and experiment. I have a paper on the archive. If you want to know more, the paper on the archive is entitled, What Can Gauge Gravity Teach Us About what can gauge gravity duality teach us about condensed matter physics. So just read that if you want to read. No more details. But let me, at this point then, try to give you another hand-waving picture of why is it that, you know, this idea of non-local entanglement and conformal field theory leads naturally to string theory. Well, with the benefit of hindsight, of course. So let me draw another, it's kind of a fanciful picture of these particles moving around. So this line here is the same as that line there. It's in d dimensions, and these particles are moving around and interacting with each other. So there are some quantum degrees of freedom, qubits, if you wish, in two or three dimensions sitting there. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to entangle these qubits with each other. And there's been a way of talking about this entanglement of qubits in a way that you get long-range entanglement by sort of using a kind of a tensor network to represent the entanglement. Some of you may know about it. There's a lot of work on it here at Perimeter. So, you know, the picture is you entangle these two in some way, and then you get some other composite degrees of freedom coming out like this, and then you take these and you decimate them, and something like here. I may not draw, I should have. Here's where I need a picture. Then you want to, I think, you want to decimate these somehow. So your two have gone to one, and then these two have become one, yeah. So now you can start entangling these, and again, keep going. So you just draw a network like this of links, and these links represent in some hierarchical structure how these things are entangled. So here, these two are entangled, these two are entangled, and then there's some composite degree of freedom which entangles them again, and so on and so forth. You build up a hierarchy of entanglement. I'm not really drawing this very well. Okay, so this is some graphical representation of some trial wave functions that people can write down. You take a trial wave function for the system where you have a whole bunch of variational parameters where you entangle these bosons with each other in a hierarchical manner. First, the nearest neighbor bosons, then the pairs of bosons, and the quadruplets of bosons, and so on and so forth, in some hierarchical structure. And that kind of structure is called a tensor network, a representation of this long-range entanglement. And I want to make a very loose analogy between this picture and this picture that a string theorist might write down. So string theorists have this object they call a D-brain, where you have a string which is sticking to some one-dimensional surface. And there are closed strings and open strings. And then there's all kinds of, and these strings go this way. So, but this is string theory here. And this is a D-brain, what they call a D-brain. It's a D-dimensional surface on which the ends of open strings can stick, okay? And at this, you know, pictorial level, all I want to claim is that this picture and this picture are basically the same. And what strings are telling you about is the entanglement between the quantum degrees of freedom. What they're really encoding is the entanglement of the quantum degrees of freedom of the D-brain. And the string theory then now, you can see, lives. Here's an what you call an emergent direction. Which is just the extra dimension in which the strings move. And this extra dimension is useful way of describing the long-range entanglement of degrees of freedom here. And this string picture then has some at least pictorial similarity to this hierarchy of entanglement, where the extra dimension here is just the level of entanglement. Okay. So that sounds very, I think I showed some of these pictures in my talk yesterday too. So it sounds very hand-wavy, but there is some meat to it. You can actually use this picture to get some intuitive understanding of what this ADCFT correspondence is. So what this picture shows you is that a CFT in D dimensions, I haven't really explained what that is, has some connection to string theory in D plus one dimensions. Okay. And this is really, in many ways, a very general and powerful connection. That if you start with the CFT, there is, usually people know it the other way. You start with the string theory, and then it just, you sort of rebrain, and you get a CFT. Okay. But in some sense, it hasn't helped you very much so far, because you have some complicated problem you can't solve here, and you have another complicated problem you can't solve, and you just learned that they're the same. Okay, so how does that help you? So where it does help you is that for certain string theories in D plus one dimensions, this is so-called large n limit, this was Maldacena's realization, for certain string theories in D plus one dimension are quite simple. So you take a large n limit, and essentially in this large n limit, this can be described by classical gravity. And usually just Einstein's gravity theory. So with some additional fields and so on. So then you have a very powerful equivalence then between this, in this large n limit, between the conformal field theory that you were talking about at the critical point and Einstein's gravity, which is just totally amazing. Because who would have thought Einstein gravity knew anything about conformal field theory or the Bose-Hubbard critical point? I mean, it just blows my mind every time I think about it. And this Einstein gravity is in one higher dimension than the conformal field theory. Now, of course, you've noticed that, you know, this involves this large n limit, which I haven't really described, and there's no large n here. You know, it's not really that model that you're interested in. For this particular model, if I write down the string theory, it's a horribly it's known what it is, but it's a horribly complicated string theory. You wouldn't want to touch it. Well, there are, one of my colleagues, C. Yin, is actually working on it. And maybe we'll know more about it eventually. But it's really a forbidding mathematical challenge to understand the precise string theory that's dual to this quantum critical point of bosons. It's known what it is. It's just so very complicated. OK. So why do we care? So now it turns out, so you know, you suspend disbelief for a while and say, OK, let me just assume that there is such a classical gravity theory. And let me just go ahead and take this classical gravity theory and compute something in the quantum critical region. After all, nothing else worked there anyway, so here's something else. Try it. See what you get. And you find you get answers that are physically very reasonable immediately. They look exactly the basic shape you wanted. They obey all the right inequalities. And everything looks just really much better than you have any right to expect. So that gives you hope. I mean, that's sort of where roughly things stand. But what you really need to do then is now look at correction. So you've got now some zeroth order theory, which is in parameter space very far away, but in physical properties very close to what you want to describe. You know, and this kind of thing happens in physics all the time. You know, the most celebrated example is probably something called the epsilon expansion. So if you want to determine the exponents or the critical properties of liquid gas critical point of carbon dioxide, you know, thing you learn about in van der Waals theory, where van der Waals gets certain square root singularities of the coexistence state, and eventually it was learned it was really 0.333 and so on. And that was eventually understood in terms of what's called the epsilon expansion, which is an expansion in powers of epsilon, which is a deviation from four dimension of the dimensionality of space. So it's 4 minus d. Now you're interested in the answer epsilon equals 1. You assume epsilon is small and expand it. And after 20 years of work, that expansion has been understood so well that we can get values in for epsilon equals 1 to some ridiculous accuracy, to 3 or 4 decimal places. And why does this work? Well, it's not because the series is convergent. We know it's not convergent. It's not particularly well-behaved either, formally, as mathematicians would never believe this. But the reason it works is that, some said it captures the right physics. It has the right behavior already at small epsilon of the basic physical phenomena. And all you have to do is just tweak it then and get the right answer. So the hope is that something like this happening here, and there's all the signs that's the case, that this classical gravity theory, when addressing this quantum critical physics, it seems to have all the right physical phenomena just at the word go immediately and in a way that no other theory before had it. And so that suggests that if you tweak it now and add more corrections with higher order derivatives and so on, and fix those coefficients in some systematic way, and we think we know how to do that, then you will have a systematic theory for a realistic system. So that's one of my programs of what I want to work on, is really nailing down this very basic problem and its connection to Einstein gravity in four dimensions. Amazingly, who would have thought there was a connection? So that's sort of a problem that has, it's of some interest to few people in the world, and been a particular obsession of mine for many years. And it's nice that string theory methods are helping, but many other people have been much more ambitious. They want to really track everything, cuprate superconductivity, antiferromagnetism, all of that should come out of these methods. And there, even at the word go, it seems very doubtful, because you don't have a conformal field theory there. No one is saying that the Hubbard model of fermions at some optimal doping, where it's high temperature superconductor, is a conformal field theory. That would be ridiculous. Even I wouldn't claim that. So how can you possibly use these methods? Well, okay, it looks hopeless, but amazingly, there's been a lot of progress, and things are starting to come together. And we're now at the stage where, even for systems that are not conformal, these are what I call compressible systems in my talk yesterday, they're now emerging results that, again, look very physical. They seem to make sense, and you get them really relatively easily, provided you choose the right theory of gravity in the right regime. And so we're developing a lot of intuition for that and seeing where all this will all take us. I think I've talked a lot. So that gives you a flavor of something I'm excited about. I mean, as I said, this started out as a sidelight for my own research, and I certainly don't, I spend less than half my time on it, maybe even smaller. Most of my time is more mainstream physics of quantum critical points and this physics, using conventional field theoretical methods and other tools. I also interact a lot with experimentalists in cuprate superconductivity and coal atoms on the problems that they're working on. This is one of the things I work on, and it's something that I think is growing quite rapidly these days. So I talked a lot. So questions? Anything else you want me to talk about, or I just shut up? Yeah.
So can you speak more detail, what predictions can we extract from this NAS site, which will be compared to experiments?
Well, so the thing we've been focusing on, one of the simplest ones, is what is the frequency dependence of the conductivity of these bosons in this quantum critical region? How does it depend on frequency and temperature? There are some predictions from the traditional methods, but they really have a very singular behavior that doesn't look very plausible. And the ADS-CFT gives immediately some rather natural shapes for the frequency-dependent conductivity. But that's just the simplest quantity. Basically, any kind of dynamical property in that region, how long does it take? If you take the system and you hit it, how long does it take before it falls back to equilibrium? How does it evolve towards equilibrium? Various nonlinear response functions. How does this respond to a magnetic field if these are charged bosons? So there's just an infinite list of properties, of dynamical properties in this region that one could, in principle, compute. The tools are there now. The experiments are also slowly coming on, looking at some of these issues. But I think the more challenging problem, the one many more people are interested in, is the problem that I discussed in my talk yesterday, which is the problem of, super high temperature superconductivity and the strange metal phase that you get in the high temperature superconductors and various spin liquid states. And there, where there is essentially no theory for the strange metal anyway. And I think this whole approach has a good chance of yielding eventually some contact with experiments. Then there's no shortage of experimental data there. But okay, let's see. Yeah.
So if one wanted to do the research in quantum mechanics, what do you think would be
good direction to go.
As in your idea, what was going to take off in the future?
Well, if I knew, I'd be doing it myself. I think, you know, I would start with some basic broad knowledge of various aspects of, you know, quantum condensed matter physics. So things like, you know, Fermi liquid theory, then BCS theory, quantum Hall states, quantum critical points like this, Kondo problems, and so on. So there's a whole list of canonical problems of that type, there are many textbooks on them, and also so I would certainly be knowledgeable all of that. And then, it depends what strikes your fancy. I mean, often what's happened in the field is that it's driven by new experimental discoveries. So in the last 2 or 3 years, there was a discovery of the ion-based superconductors. That's given a whole new impetus to thinking about how Fermi surface change in the presence of magnetism and how that leads to superconductivity. There's been a lot of progress in that question. There's been the, you know, graphene, which single-layer graphene is relatively simple, but now they're bilayer graphene and various other geometries. There's tons of experiments on that. And all these methods of quantum condensed matter physics apply there. Oh, I should have also mentioned topological insulators. Of course, it's a very hot topic these days, which is graphene-like anyway, as far as the surface is concerned. So many of the issues are quite similar. And then there's cold atoms. So there's, again, I think these kind of lattice experiments, which started out with bosons and now being done with fermions in greater and greater precision. And so many interesting phases are being discovered. So one particular thing I worked on just last year, you know, I talked about taking the system and tilting it a little bit, but there's nothing to stop the experimentalists from tilting it a lot. And that turns out to lead to surprisingly rich physics and lots of new phases, some of which we predicted. And there's been now a whole series of experiments on that. So the cold atom field also continues to grow. So, you know, I would have the broad knowledge in all of these methods of quantum condensed matter physics, and then, you know, who knows, by the time you're starting your research, there's some other new experimental discovery and you have to jump on it. It's good to be early. That's when the opportunity is the best. I guess what I was talking about here was more of a formal theoretical set of tools, which this will continue, and it's also very exciting. But most of condensed matter physics is driven by these experimental discoveries, I would say. And fortunately, there's been every year or two, there's something in the last, you know, basically, last 10 years, you can easily make the case that's been happening. So that's been great. There are also now very interesting experiments, which I'm just starting to get interested in, on taking systems like these, or bosons, and putting them in optical cavities, where you have active exchange of energy between two-level systems on the bosons and modes of the cavity. And that, I think, also there's a lot of rich physics there. And many, many experiments starting in that direction. Yeah.
What do you think about RVD?
RVB is the idea of spin liquids. So now there are many candidates for spin liquids, not in the cuprates, but in organic insulators. Now for the cuprates, I would say that, you know, the idea that that there's a spin liquid mod insulator, which is controlling what's happening at finite doping, is probably not correct in its original formulation. But when you look carefully at the finite, you know, near optimal doping in the strange metal, you're talking about metallic states. And we do need to understand what those metallic states are like, and these ideas from RVB are playing an important role in that. So there's a generalized version of RVB, which, you know, call many names, but what we really need to understand, not so much spin liquids, but exotic metallic states. I think that's, and all the things we've learned from RVB are going to be really crucial. So I think exotic metallic states will play an important role in understanding high-temperature superconductivity. yeah, I mean, to me, that's really one of the key problems, in fact. That's what was behind what I was talking about yesterday. I mean, there's also, you know, these spin liquid insulators are also extremely interesting. They don't, again, they don't fit the simplest kind of spin-on Fermi surface wave function I mentioned very briefly yesterday, which has been the major focus of many, many theorists. And so people are now putting out other proposals on, because there's some key feature of the experiment that look very mysterious. And so we have a proposal trying to explain it using Majorana fermion spin liquids, and we'll see where that goes. But it at least consistent with two experiments, but okay. We'll see though. It has to be studied a little more carefully theoretically. Okay, so great, thanks for listening. And I hope you all, I don't know, if you're interested in any of this, do apply to Harvard. I am looking for students. I had, last year had 5 students graduate, and so I have, and I'm never gonna go up to that many, but there are openings.